The following interviews and commentaries are for entertainment only. The views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
It's time again for Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio with the latest news and conversation related to firearms and your Second Amendment rights. Sponsored by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. And now, Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in throughout the hour to join us, 458-8255. 458 Talk, what is on your mind about firearms today? And it's another great day in Fairbanks, the golden heart of President Andrew Johnson's Polar Bear Garden, also known as Seward's Folly. And yesterday in history, I'm a day behind, yesterday in history, October 18, 1867, Alaska's purchase from the Russian Empire on March 30th, 1867, was formally transferred to the United States. So today in the Polar Bear Garden, the sky looks like the snow is going to fall. It's 25 degrees. And here at the KFAR broadcasting station, Melissa is again expertly running the board for us. Thank you, Melissa.
You're welcome. Yes. And the archives are up to date.
Oh, great, great. Okay, so I don't have to tell you about the archives. Just know that if you miss a program, Melissa keeps the archives up to date for us. So what is on our agenda today? We will continue our book review and stories about W.D. M. Bell, known as Karamojo Bell, who wrote Wanderings of an Elephant Hunter in 1923. And I want to share a brief quote from Joe Navarro's book, Dangerous Personalities, about boiling frogs. And then a mention of today's holiday, which leaves me speechless in light of current world events. And I have some follow-up for Randy on the elephant meat. So I'll do the announcements first. Check into Reardon's upcoming Alaska Concealed Handgun Permit classes are November 4th and 5th and December 9th and 10th, noon to 4 on Saturday and 9 to 5 on Sunday at Alaska Ammo. And if you're going to take the Alaska Concealed Handgun Permit class, take it from an instructor who has deep experience in both handguns and law enforcement, as well as numerous high-level certifications. And from Chuck, you're going to get the real thing, because he's an instructor with deep lifetime experience in both, as I said, firearms handling and law enforcement. And I mentioned last week, when you choose a firearms class, go for the most experienced instructor with the deepest background and the one who past students recommend. That is very important. And an instructor who knows how to teach and how to work with students. Chuck does have a master's degree in education. These concealed carry classes are not generic classes, so take it from an instructor with a reputation for his knowledge in that field and his ability to transfer that knowledge to the students. Chuck is offering another class, Defensive Handgun for the Armed Citizen class, next week, October 28th and 29th. And again, on December 16 and 17. Now, I went through the scenarios in that class in April of this year, and you can find my review of it in two parts. Part one is April 20th, 2023, and part two is May 4th, 2023, all in the archives, thanks to Melissa. And on the first day of the defensive handgun, I just went through the scenarios, but on the first day of the defensive handgun for the armed citizen class, Chuck concentrates on helping you perfect your defensive gun skills. And he'll also cover the law, use of force, and what you need to legally know to defend yourself. On the second day of class, Chuck starts by explaining some defensive techniques you need to know how to apply to safely operate in an intruder or otherwise bad guy situation. And next, Chuck creates scenarios for a number of real life situations where you have to make a decision how you would handle it, and you will use airsoft guns. I won't tell you the building location. You'll find out when you take the class, but the building has several staircases, stairwell setups, and numerous rooms where Chuck and his aides can stage real-life scenarios, and you walk into the situation having access to it sometimes in the middle of chaos, like the situation's going on and you're walking into it to assess it. Victims may be screaming, or maybe it's just you and the bad guy, and you have to decide how to handle it. And so why is it important to take this type of training? Because you will be put under stress, and actually much of the stress, at least in my case, was self-induced. Chuck calls it stress inoculation. And I now know from taking Chuck's defensive handgun for the armed citizens class that sitting around in my home thinking about how I would handle a situation simply does not cut it when I'm in that situation under stress. I personally made a number of miscalculations in a couple of scenarios. I also learned that I did not see some evident clues, perhaps due to tunnel vision, but obviously some sort of stress element. I completely walked past a bad guy in one scenario, and that could have been a deadly area in real life. I just didn't see that bad guy at all, even though right before that exercise, Chuck and his helper demonstrated the proper way to maneuver in that very situation. So he demonstrated, and then we went into that situation, and I just completely lost it because of stress. So under stress, we tend to forget, but less so if we take a class like Chuck is offering and then practice what we're taught. And I learned, and now I won't make that mistake again. So many of us have adequate, or maybe some of our listeners have exceptional firearms handling and target acquisition skills, but that doesn't mean we can mentally process a defensive situation and make proper decisions under stress. It's two different things, and we need to be good at both. So Chuck, his wife Cindy, and Chuck's helpers were great. They're friendly, they're helpful, and on the scenario day, there was pizza for lunch. That was great. So sign up for Chuck's Alaska Concealed Handgun Permit classes or the upcoming October 28th and 29th Defensive Handgun for the Armed Citizen classes on his website. Alaska Ammo also has information about Chuck's classes. And if you want to be on Chuck's mailing list or have any questions about his classes, call him 844-966-4079 or go to his website, c4traininggroup.com. And moving on, Glenn Miller's upcoming NRA metallic cartridge reloading class is ready for registrants on the AIMCOM website are January 6th and April 27th of 2024. Remember, Glenn's an excellent instructor. He also has deep knowledge and a lifetime, almost a lifetime, of experience. I think he started very young with the reloading in what he teaches. I took Glenn's NRA metallic cartridge reloading class last fall, October 29th. Look in the Shooter's Corner archives for December 8th, and I talked about my experience in Glenn's classes on December 8th. So sign up at the AIMCOM website or call Glenn at 907-347-1396. And if you want to be in a future reloading class and the dates aren't listed on the AIMCOM website, just call Glenn and let him know. And one more from Glenn. Mass is back. That's Miller's Action Speed Shooting. The first mass of the season is action shooting, speed shooting at steel targets. It's Saturday, November 4 at the Fishing Game Range. And you can shoot either rimfire or centerfire or both because Glenn acquired a professional level steel target system. It's a great system. Beginners as well as experienced shooters are welcome. New shooters and juniors under 18 shoot free. Bring your family. You can sign up at Practice Score, PRACTISCORE, practicescore.com. And for more information, call Glenn at 907-347-1396. And one last one. The Indoor Winter Cowboys are shooting at TVSA this Sunday, October 22nd. Doors open 1 o'clock. Shots downrange 2 p.m. And first-time ladies and juniors under 18 shoot free. They will loan you the guns the first couple times, bring 100 rounds of .22 ammo. The returning shooters pay $20, but returning juniors will only pay $10. But as I said, first-time ladies and juniors shoot free. So you can call Jay Giesen for more information, 907-750-0043. Jay's cowboy name is Cougar, but he's one of the nicest and most helpful gun sport people you will ever meet. He's been involved in the sports in Fairbanks for many years.
If I was going to choose a name, I'd probably choose Cougar, too.
Cougar.
I like it.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
It's got a lot of good meanings.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a
okay.
good one.
Yeah. Okay. So let me see if I can talk about elephant meat before we go on break here. So last week, Randy asked about elephant meat, and I asked my friend in Zimbabwe about whether elephant meat was sold in grocery stores or actually sold anywhere for that matter in his country and what it tastes like. And elephant hunting is restricted by permit. There are restrictions on the disposition of the meat depending on the area the elephant is hunted, whether it's a safari, or it could be the government calling elephants. In Zimbabwe, the meat usually goes to the villagers. And here is my friend's answer. I described it from his WhatsApp reply. Quote, "Your question on elephant meat, it is definitely not sold in grocery shops. It is very, very tough meat. You can hardly eat it. You have to boil it for days, basically, and then it is still even tough. It's not sold. It's not very nice meat. And they say the best part of the elephant's meat, if you want to eat it, the hunters from long back, they used to take the meat of the temples, and they used to cook it on the fires and eat it. But yes, it's tough and it's very coarse. The meat itself is coarse," end quote. So that is a white person's opinion of elephant meat. I know my friend's family has taken 3 elephants over the years, but years ago, the rules were different. I think the tribal peoples have different assessments of elephant meat. They like it. And today or next week, we'll get to Karamo Joe Bell's explanation of eating elephant meat. And while I was in Zimbabwe and Vori, where my friend lives, Peter's daughter and I walked over to his parents' home. Let's see if I go real quick or should we go to break?
Go ahead, finish.
Okay. And his parents had lovely elephant footstools and footrests and several pairs of large elephant ivory on proper stands. And my friend Peter shot his first elephant when he was 15 years old. He was hunting with his father. And his mother told me that back then, years ago, if a hunter legally took an elephant under a specific program the country had for citizens to apply for a hunt, they could sell the meat if they didn't want to keep it all. And my friend's mother said it was not worth all the work to carve up and process an elephant, even if you could sell some of it. The natives, however, seem very grateful to have elephant meat. Another friend of mine who killed an elephant on safari told me that when the village was notified, they all showed up to cut up the meat and carry it off. And one lady actually kneeled down in front of him and thanked him for killing the elephant for them. So this is in Zimbabwe, where the villages in that area, the campfire area, would get the meat from a safari client's hunt and some of the fees paid for that hunt. And CAMFIRE stands for Community Areas Management Program for Indigenous Resources. That's all I've got on elephant meat, and we're going to break. Stay with us.
Out in Arizona where the bad men are, the only thing to guide you is an evening star. The roughest, toughest man by far was Ragtime Cowboy Joe. He got his name from singing to the cows.
As you brush your teeth and comb your hair, think about your faithful friend in your driveway. While you visit your doctor or dentist, remember your four-wheeled pal in the parking lot. You do your own routine maintenance. Your car or truck depends on you to do that for them. Call the folks with experience and a sound reputation since 1967. Rogers Auto Repair, from tune-ups to complete rebuilds. Airboat and inboard service as well. Family-owned and operated, Rogers Auto Repair.
Who turned out the lights? Never get stuck in the dark with Auto Trim Design Moose Lights and backup lights on your vehicle. They're the best in the interior. See Auto Trim Design's wide variety of Vision X, Putco, and VLED lights that fit most vehicles. Stop in or give us a call, 456-8400, and we'll design the right setup that fits your lifestyle. Auto Trim Design's philosophy hasn't changed in over 20 years. We treat every customer the Alaskan way, with honesty, integrity, and respect.
Customized by Auto Trim.
Weather brought to you by Bigfoot Pumping and Thawing, offering 24-hour service from Salcha to Nanana and no mileage charge on callouts. The Bigfoot with the helping hand. Bigfoot Pumping and Thawing.
KFAR weather.
Chance of snow today, otherwise cloudy skies. High temperatures reach up to 27. Winds out of the west, 15 to 20 miles per hour. Cloudy skies expected tonight. Chance for snow, lows level off around 17. Cloudy skies with a few peaks of sun tomorrow. Chance of snow, highs level off around 26. A dusting of snow today. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Welcome back. This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz and Melissa Burnett on the controls, KFAR Radio. Please call in at 458-8255-458-TALK and let us know what's on your mind about firearms today. So I have a comment on current events. Back in August, I mentioned I read the book Dangerous Personalities by Joe Navarro and recommended it as a book many of us might want to read. And I won't review it, but when we have time, I will talk about the last couple chapters in that book because the applications of Navarro's observations seem universal to me in many situations. And Navarro concentrates on individual personalities of people, those dangerous personalities that can harm us in many ways, and how we can be on the lookout for those types of people. And I was thinking about something he said in one of the final chapters because to me it pertains to the current Middle East situation. Terroristic groups are run by dangerous personalities, and countries sponsoring terroristic groups are run by dangerous rulers. And it seems to me dangerous to both their own people and to us in the United States and to European countries, and especially in this case to Israel in this current situation. It is a saying that we have all heard before, and I want to share it quickly so we remember it, both for individuals we might deal with or for wider applications like the situation in the Middle East. And so I will quote from Mr. Navarro's book in Chapter 6 titled Self-Defense Against Dangerous Personalities. Quote, "You probably know the story of how to boil a frog. You put it in boiling water and it'll leap out. But if you put it in tepid water and slowly increase the temperature, the frog won't even know it's slowly boiling to death." At the FBI, when we interview people who'd been victimized by a dangerous personality, I heard versions of this refrain over and over. By the time I realized what was going on, it was too late. Now, our ability to adapt is a powerful survival mechanism, but with dangerous personalities, we may boil to death before we realize we're in hot water, unquote. Well, the water's been hot in the Middle East for all the years I can remember in my lifetime. Dangerous personalities turned the flame up on the water, and now a horribly large number of people on both sides have lost their lives. And ironically, for history today, after the mention of dangerous personalities, boiling water, and the Middle East, today's holiday is Conflict Resolution Day. And for this hour, I think at this point it's better to move on and visit Karamojo Bell. And if I talk really fast, maybe I'll get to the point where Mr. Bell solved a conflict with his trusty Mauser pistol. All right, let's move on to our book review. Continuing the discussion of WDM or Walter Dalrymple Maitland Bell, also known as Karamojo Bell, his book, The Wanderings of an Elephant Hunter. I started this book review on September 21 and talked about it each week since all those transcripts, thanks to Melissa, are in the archives. And we left off last week. It's kind of hard to keep track of all this. We left off last week, part one of chapter 5, titled Karamojo. And this chapter goes back to the beginning of Bell's hunts in Africa. And eventually it winds its way to how Bell was able to understand elephant anatomy well enough to develop his Bell shots and his confidence in his various body shots. And I will finish that up. Hopefully we will move on to part two of chapter five. Part two is titled Ivory and the Raiders, and that is where Mr. Bell's Mauser pistol makes its debut. We left off last week learning that Bell, who was outfitting his safari in the town of Mimias in Uganda, was about to enter, quote, into this country of suspicion and brooding violence, unquote. The locals would not help him. They were not forthcoming with helpful information. He soon figured out the reason, and this is a re-quote from last week, but it soon became clear when I crossed the Turkwell and found that the peaceful, polite, prosperous-looking traders at Mamias became the merciless and bloody dacoitas soon as he crossed that river and was no longer under European control, unquote. And that means the peaceful traders turned into armed robbers and murderers when there was no European control. And we also learned the government agent provided Bell with 8 Snyder rifles to defend himself with, and aside from those, Bell had his personal rifles, a 303 Lee Enfield, a 275 Rigby Mauser, and a double 450-400. And Bell also had his Mauser pistol, which could be used as a carbine, quote, which soon acquired the name of Boom Boom and a reputation for itself equal to 100 ordinary rifles, unquote. And so now we'll move forward with new information. Bell also tells us that while searching through boxes of loose ammunition at a Mamaya store, hoping to find a few good rounds for the Snyder carbines, he found a Martini Henry cartridge. Quote, and while looking at its base, it suddenly struck me that possibly it could be fired from a Snyder. and it proved to be, and so it proved to be, end quote. And I'll get to Bell's comments about the Martini Henry cartridge in a minute, but first let me quote the footnote from the book. And I believe these footnotes actually, they're just notes in small print typed under a paragraph where the subject is discussed. And I suspect they're likely added by the editors who reprinted the edition that I have. Quote, this is the footnote, quote, "The single-shot Martini was a powerful breech-loading rifle popular with the British in India who, no doubt, enjoyed the novel simplicity of dropping a projectile in the rear of the rifle instead of packing its muzzle. The Martini superseded the Snyder, which was a muzzle loader," unquote, and end of footnote. Since this is a firearms program, I'll share what Bell says about the Martini Henry cartridges and the Snyder carbines. Quote, "The base being 577 caliber fitted perfectly. But the bullet, being only 450 bore, was scarcely what you might call a good fit for a 577 barrel, and there was, of course, no accuracy to the thing at all. But it went off with a bang, and the propensity of its bullet to fly off at the most disconcerting angles after rattling through the barrel from side to side, it seemed to just suit the style of aiming adopted by my eight Askaris," Askaris are soldier, "for on several occasions, Jackal and Hyena were laid low while prowling around the camp at night," end quote. And we have a caller.
We do. We have a caller.
Oh, caller, you're on the line. Are you there?
One short idea.
Okay. Can you repeat that? Because I didn't hear it.
I just had one.
Yes. Idea. Yes. Yes. Please.
I shot a .22 Martini action.
Oh.
For 2 years in 50-foot. Ranges there at Ryan School.
Oh.
And, probably TBSA. Yeah.
Okay.
So, anyway, yeah, I'm familiar with that Martini word. That's it. Thanks.
Okay. Do you still, you probably already have, but did you still have it? I guess it's probably
I traded it for a 44 Magnum when I was old enough to, buy a pistol.
Okay. Okay. One more question. Was that yours? Did you buy it or your family bought it or how did you come across that gun up here?
My father bought that for me at the auction of Howard Coons. Howard Coons lived in the log house where the hairdresser shop is across from AIH or the old Pan Pack building.
Oh, how interesting. Well, I wonder where in the world it is today.
Well, Howard Coons died in a bear mauling. Lake Manitou, maybe?
Minichuma?
Nope. Mucho Lake.
Oh, Mucho, okay.
That's the name I remember. He did, I think, get mauled by a bear out there on a fishing trip.
Oh, dear. This is a lot of good history.
Howard Coons, yeah, that's a way old name.
Okay. I'm going to have to look that up. Interesting. And thank you for all of this.
Thanks for your show.
Okay. All right. Well, that was a little slice of Fairbanks. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm going to have to do a little digging.
Yeah.
I wonder if the newspaper at the time, you know, there's probably
some. I've heard
the
name.
Okay.
that name before. I don't know much about the name, but I've heard that name.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, interesting.
Yeah, and to shoot a martini. That's great. Thank you, caller. Okay, so now Bell is ready to start out on his safari, or what he calls starts out into the unknown. And Bell's Askari had a rifle. And one of the Snyder rifles in his hide belt. And, you know, I can't tell from reading the book whether it was one Askari he gave the rifle to. He had a number of them. Or if all the Askaris had rifles. Or maybe he didn't give anyone but one person a rifle. And then if there was going to be any trouble, he would have distributed the rifles. It isn't really clear from reading the book. But I'm assuming it was just one Askari had the Snyder rifle. And he had in his hide belt 5 Martini cartridges. And the native Askari, Bell says the native Askari was proud of this, and he had polished his cartridges with bright to make them bright and shiny with sand, and he also polished the worn barrel of the old Snyder rifle, and the Askari had a piece of fat from the tail of a sheep hanging from the hammer, and I tried to find out what the significance of that might have been, but Google didn't provide me with anything, so fat from the tail of a sheep hanging from the hammer. So safari porters, they were balancing large and small loads of gear and provisions on their head. Bell's Safari left Mamias with none of the usual celebrations normally given for these occasions by the townspeople. And as they made their way to the Turkwell River that flows from Mount Elgon on the border between Kenya and Uganda to Lake Turkana, Bell was able to shoot a hartebeest and an arubi to feed the safari. And an arubi is, if I'm pronouncing it right, is a small antelope. It's about 20 to 26 inches high, and it has big ears, and it can run 25 to 30 miles an hour. They reached the Turkwell River on their seventh day of trekking, and Bell says that throughout the river's entire course, at the time of his writing of the book, immense herds of elephants come to drink there. During dry season, when the flowing water dries up, the elephants and the natives, they make holes in the sands in the riverbed, and that helps them reach the pooled water under the sand underneath. Quote, "Dreadful tales of murders of peaceful travelers had been related by Swahilis, and we were careful not to let anyone straggle far from the main body. At night, my eight askaris mounted guard and kept a huge fire going. Their vigilance was extraordinary, and their keenness and cheerfulness and fidelity and courage a very high order, showing them to be born soldiers. Their shooting was simply atrocious. In spite of practice with a 22 I had, but notwithstanding their inability to align and aim the rifle properly, they used to sometimes bring off the most brilliant shots under the most impossible conditions of shooting light, and thereby showing a great natural aptitude to point the gun and time the shot." And we're going to go to our half-hour break, and I'm going to talk about that last statement when we get back.
Talk radio station, 97.5 FM, 660 AM KFAR.
News, I'm John Saucier. Families with children that are still missing in Gaza pleading for help in Tel Aviv.
The last contact that we had with them was on 9:58 in the morning, Saturday morning. The
Israeli military is trying to negotiate the release of hostages before a ground invasion of Gaza. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell says while they've made progress toward combating inflation, high prices still affecting Americans.
These shorter-term measures are often volatile. And in any case, inflation is still too high. And a few months of good data are only the beginning of what it will take to build confidence that inflation is moving down sustainably toward our goal.
He says the Fed will be careful in its next steps to combat inflation. And it looks like Congressman Jim Jordan is back down in his bid for House speakership. He'll support a plan to give Congressman Patrick McHenry, the temporary speaker, additional powers until January. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The Fairbanks Daily Newsminer reports a Delta Junction mother and daughter were arrested Tuesday, 2 months after a fatal hit and run. The women claim the driver of the vehicle hit a moose rather than fatally hitting a man. Troopers say, however, the duo strategically placed moose hair in the truck's engine compartment in an effort to back up their claim. According to Alaska State Troopers, 47-year-old John Emmerich of Delta Junction was struck and killed by a hit-and-run driver around 10 p.m. August 29th, just south of Delta Junction on the Alaska Highway. A man told troopers that his ex-girlfriend, 32-year-old Chelsea Erickson, contacted him around the time of the hit and run. During the contact, she was crying and intoxicated, reporting she struck a moose with her truck, the complaint stated. Cell phone GPS data placed Chelsea Erickson's phone within 100 meters of the crash site, traveling southbound on the Alaska Highway at 10:06 p.m. on the night of the accident. On Tuesday, troopers discovered a truck in a detached garage next to the Erickson's house. Blood, biological matter, and human hair covered the entire underside of the truck, the complaint states. The Erickson's are now being held at FCC.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
Ben here at Auto Trim Design. Summer is moving down the road, and that means it's time to start getting ready for winter. At Auto Trim Design, we have something for everyone. Get your remote start with drone mobile, moose lights, heated seats, seat covers, tonneau covers, toppers, WeatherTech floor liners, and more before the snow flies. Auto Trim Design is your one-stop shop for all your vehicle accessory needs, located at 2550 South Cushman Street under the huge American flag. Stop in or give us a call at 456-8400.
Customized by Auto Trim.
Alaska is new every season. Fall and winter bring new sporting opportunities for grouse, ptarmigan, and other small game hunting. Predator calling and trapping, snowshoeing, and winter camping. Gear up for success at Frontier Outfitters for traps, snares, and calls, guns, and ammunition. You'll stay warm and dry with the right clothing and rest easy with tents, sleeping bags, and camp necessities. Just downstairs, you'll find ATV and snow machine accessories and Sentry Hardware. For every season, there's Frontier Outfitters for your Alaskan lifestyle.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Welcome back. This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz and Melissa Burnett, KFAR Radio. Please call in at 458-8255-458-TALK and let us know what's on your mind about firearms today. And I really appreciate the caller that called in. I'm going to do some research on that. Thank you very much about the martini and Mr. Coon. So when I left off before the break, I was saying that Mr. Bell thought the native shooting with his Snyder rifles, he tried to train him, but he said they're shooting was simply atrocious, and talked about their inability to align and aim a rifle properly. And then he said they did occasionally pull off an impossible shot successfully, and they showed by doing that a great natural, quote, a great natural aptitude to point the gun and time the shot, unquote. So I got to thinking about Bell's last statement, and it reminds me of our conversations about red dots and iron sights and information that I give students. What I usually tell students is we developed as humans that through spears using our natural ability to extend and throw a projectile with proper timing. We did not aim down a sight on our spears. We instinctively knew how to aim and time the thrust of that spear. And that is much of how early man and certainly African natives hunted. So it makes perfect sense to me that sighting the rifle to aim at an animal would be difficult for a native as throwing a spear might be for us. And I think the native Askari simply pointed the rifle as if it were a spear to them, an extension of their arm, and instead of thrust at the proper time, they just pulled the trigger, and that's how they pulled off those shots. And speaking of spears, next comes along two Karamojans with long thrusting spears strolling into Bell's safari camp. And it amazes me in books that I've read about early white wagon trekkers or the white elephant hunters, the natives seem to appear out of nowhere to either trade groundnuts or mealy meal for meat or tell the white hunter where the animals or water holes are so that the white hunter who only wanted to hunt trophy and enough meat to feed a safari would in exchange give the wandering tribal members the remaining meat to take back to their villages. And it seemed to me that in such an immense, roadless, dangerous country that natives must know from watching birds or listening to animals or their acute sense of smell where the white wagon trekkers or the white hunter would be. So back to the book, the natives were suspicious of Bell. These two natives with their spears were suspicious of Bell, and rightly so with all of that deadly raiding that was going on. But Bell explained his sole purpose was hunting elephant, and he asked if the natives had seen any, and if so, where might they be? And Bell did have an interpreter with him. And the natives told him there were many elephants, but would not say where they were. Rather, they asked Bell how he would kill them when he saw them. Quote, on showing them my rifle, they laughed and said they had seen Swahili traders using those things for elephants, and although they killed men well enough, they were useless against elephants. And my answer to this was that I had procured some wonderful medicine which enabled me to kill the largest size elephants with one shot. And if they would like to see this medicine working, all they had to do was show me where the elephants were and that I would do the rest, and they should have as much meat as they wanted, unquote. And the Karamoja replied to Bell that if his medicine allowed him to instantaneously kill an elephant, why did not that medicine show him where the elephants were? And Bell had to think up an answer, so he replied, quote, I grieved heartily over this deficiency, which I attributed to the jealousy of a medicine man who was a rival of him who had given me the killing medicine, unquote. And at this point, the two Karamojans weren't totally convinced, but Bell gave them a quarter of a buck meat and told them that he killed that kind of meat every day. And the natives walked off with the meat, but didn't tell Bell where the elephants were, and Bell thought he saw the last of them. So the next morning, Bell's safari continued, and he went about 7 miles when those two natives who had visited the day before with the meat and, you know, that had taken the meat, they came walking towards him. And speaking through Bell's interpreter, the Karamojans told Bell that four large elephants had passed their camp that morning and were likely still in the vicinity. Quote, "At once I was for going, but the interpreter and the headman both cautioned me against treachery, declaring that it was only a trick to separate us preparatory to a general massacre. This view I thought a bit far-fetched, but I ordered the safari to get underway and to travel well together until they reached the first water, where they were immediately to cut sufficient thorn trees to completely encircle themselves in camp, to keep a good lookout and to await my coming." Unquote. And I can tell you from personal experience that some African thorns are huge and they rip your pants and they can even stop you in your tracks while you have to unhook yourself. And those kinds are called wait a bit thorns because you have to wait a bit while you extract yourself. And I got caught a few times in thorns while I was walking from the cottage to Lake Kariba until I learned to look down and spot and avoid the culprit bushes. So the thorn or reed fences are known as bomas in Eastern and Central Africa, and otherwise they're known as kraal. K-R-A-L-L, kind of like our corral, but it's just one kraal in the Portuguese settled areas of Africa. So there's the bomas and there's corrals, and they're kind of the same thing. And they're either an enclosure for cattle or a complete outer perimeter fence to enclose everyone inside for safety. And in some stories I read, the white trekkers or white hunters would have their native porters build a fence structure each night as they traveled. And some were tasked with keeping the fires going all night so that the lions and hyenas would not kill the oxen and the horses or steal any meat that was hanging or kill any humans. So Bell was wandering in this uncharted land in terms of white hunters. And during the time he was embarking on this first safari, there were deadly raids, as I talked about, by the native tribes and traders. And he was working with tribal people who knew no science at all, only medicine. And Bell had the ability to understand how the natives thought. Bell had to shoot an animal for protein almost every day to keep his safari fed, and meat spoiled very quickly in that environment, and the only way to store it was to dry strips into biltong. Safaris were on the move in those days, so drying meat was difficult, so you had to shoot fresh meat almost every day, or you ended up just eating porridge. The porters could carry some water, but Bell would have to seek out sources every few days, if not sooner. His oxen needed water, and he was traveling in the dry season. And Bell noted that as the caravan moved forward, he could hear the crunching of darning needle-sized thorns under the elephant hide sandals that his guides wore. Quote, "Supremely undemonstrative, as the natives usually are, there was yet observable a kind of suppressed excitement about their bearing. And I noticed that whenever a certain bird called on the right hand, the leader would make a low remark to his companions with an indescribably satisfied kind of gesture, whereas the same calling on the left hand drew no notice from them beyond a certain increased forward resolution and a stiff ignoring of it. The significance of these signs were lost on me at the time, but I was to come to learn them well in my later dealings with these tribes. They were omens and indicated success or failure to our hunting." Unquote. Now, Bell thought the bird calls were favorable because the safari moved at a steady pace, and as they approached the Turkwell Valley, elephant sign became more frequent. And he describes huge paths worn perfectly smooth with edges cut as clear as those of garden walks by the huge pads of the elephants. Individual paths began to run together to form more deeply worn ones as the elephants approached their drinking places along the river. And here's a quote, "Halt! The little line bunches up against the motionless natives. A distant rumble resembling somewhat a cart crossing a wooden bridge, and after a few seconds of silence, the crash of a broken tree. Elephants, a tomal in Karamojo, a tomal. A kind of excitement seizes us all, me most of all, the Karamojans least. Now the boys are told to stay behind and make no noise. They are at liberty to climb trees if they like. I took my .303, but of course it had been ready for hours. Noting that the wind, what there was of it, was favorable, the natives and I go forward and soon come upon the broken trees, the mimosa, the white thorn, the chewed fibrous balls of sansevieria, I think that's right, and moist patches with froth still on them and the still steaming unoxidized spore, and the huge tracks with heavily imprinted clear-cut corrugations of a very recently passing bench of bull elephants, unquote. Bell thought there were five elephants, and he explains, and if you think about it, these elephants appear from far, far away if they're grazing to move very slowly and leisurely. But if you're tracking them, you realize that their leisurely pace is actually quite fast and vigorous for a human. So just think about how much ground something the size of an elephant can cover, even if moving slowly. It's very hard for a human to keep up. So Bell says that each step of their lowest gait, their slowest gait, is about 6 feet of movement forward. So Bell stalked within 20 yards, his Karamojans behind him. He describes himself at this point with having intense excitement, with the usual signs being hard breathing through the mouth, dry palate, and an intense longing to shoot. So he decided to try for the elephant with the largest tusk. Quote, with extraordinary precautions against making noise and stoopings and contortions of the body, all of which, after experience, taught me were totally unnecessary, I got away off at the right angles to the file of elephants and could not grasp the fact that they were all very large and carried superb ivory. I was now almost lighthearted with excitement and several times on the very verge of firing a stupid and hasty shot from my humping and flickering rifle. So shaky was it when I once tried to put it to my shoulder that even in my then state of mind, I saw no good would come of it. And I see no good is coming of this because we're going to a commercial. So I hope it's a good commercial. And stay with us. We'll finish this up around the corner.
To winter with a friend, your Snowway snowplow. Snowway plows are stronger, smarter, the most reliable plow in the industry. Their wireless controls eliminate messy dash installations and provide the ultimate in-cab flexibility. Better yet, Snowway's patented down pressure hydraulics increase your plowing efficiency by 30%. The drive-in mount system hooks up in seconds, and their structural plow warranty is the best in the business. Stop by Rogers Auto Repair, your Snowway dealer on Dale Road near the airport, or call 479-6665.
Who turned out the lights? Never get stuck in the dark with Auto Trim Design Moose lights and backup lights on your vehicle. They're the best in the interior. See Auto Trim Design's wide variety of Vision X, Putco, and VLED lights that fit most vehicles. Stop in or give us a call, 456-8400, and we'll design the right setup that fits your lifestyle. Auto Trim Design's philosophy hasn't changed in over 20 years. We treat every customer the Alaskan way, with honesty, integrity, and respect.
KFAR weather.
Snow likely today, otherwise cloudy skies. High temperatures reach up to 27. West winds 15 to 20 miles an hour. Chance for snow tonight, low is around 17. Overcast skies. Chance for snow tomorrow, highs around 26. A dusting of snow today. That's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Eric Height.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Welcome back. This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz and Melissa Burnett on the controls, KFAR Radio. Please call in at 458-8255-458-TALK and let us know what's on your mind about firearms or anything we're talking about today. So I just said that Bell realized he was a little bit nervous about the shooting. He was all excited and he was shaky, and so he decided to wait a bit to take the shot, and he calmed himself down, and he thought he was about 20 yards from the elephants, but he was actually, he realized, 40 yards, and that was interesting to me because I'm not sure what caused that disparity, but I will bet it's the psychological state when his target was just looming large. He probably thought he was a lot closer than he really was. So he fired for the elephant's heart. Quote, with a flinch, a squirm, and a roar, he was soon in rapid motion straight away with his companions in full flight ahead of him. And of course, this is all before Bell perfected the headshot. Bell was surprised the elephants took flight so quickly in such uninhabited territory. He expected the elephants to be unsophisticated. Then that's his word. In that they might not know they were being hunted, but they did know, and Bill thought it might be because the Swahili traders had pumped lead into them before. So Bill next writes, quote, "I legged it for the cloud of dust where the fleeting animals had disappeared. Being clad in running shorts and light shoes, it was not long before I almost ran slap against the huge and motionless gray stern." And I'm skipping a little bit and then continuing. "And so it was, for as I stared goggle-eyed, the mighty body began to sway from side to side more and more until with a crash it fell sideways, bearing earthwards with it a fair-sized tree," unquote. So now the elephant's down. And immediately after the elephant falls, Bill notices another elephant from the group at about 100 yards, and he runs to it close enough for a shot. Quote, "I sat quickly down and fired carefully at its shoulder when much of the same performance took place as the first case, except that number two came down to a slow walk after a burst of speed instead of to a standstill as with number one. Ranging rapidly along slide, I quickly put him out of his misery and tore after the others, which were, of course, by this time, thoroughly alarmed and in full flight," unquote. So Bell tried to follow, but he found he was just worn out, and so he sat down, rolled himself a cigarette of strong black, what they called shag, and that was a substance commonly smoked by the Swahilis, and his native guides just beamed with satisfaction. And back at the two dead elephants, they cut their tails off. And this is a custom. And even today, hunters on safari, when they do that, they cut the tail off when they take an elephant. And if someone else, the reason they do that is if someone else should come across the carcass before a hunter gets back to it, the cutting of the tail shows that elephant has been claimed. So it was getting dark, so they left the tailless elephants, the two elephants, and trekked back to the village of the Karamojans that were in his safari. And the next day, they would deal with the ivory and the meat. And Bell said as soon as he got back to the village, he sat down at the campfire and, quote, "a group of naked savages stood looking silently at the white man and his preparations for eating and sleeping," unquote. So Bell put a kettle on the fire for tea and strips of biltong, that was the sun-dried meat, on the embers to sizzle. His boys cut the grass and spread it for a mattress. Quote, "Over this, the canvas sheet and blankets, and with a bag of cartridges wrapped in a coat for a pillow, the bed was complete. Then two forked sticks stuck in the ground close alongside the bed to hold the rifle, and all was ready for the night," unquote. So we just finished part one of chapter five. Chapter 5 is titled Karamojo. Part 1 was titled Into the Unknown. And now we're going to enter Part 2 of Chapter 5. And Part 2 is titled Ivory and the Raiders. This does get a little hard to track. So picking up where Part 1 left off, so now this is Part 2, Bell starts out with, he says that after a heavy supper, so that's what he just described the night before, after a heavy supper of toasted biltong and native flour porridge, which he washed down with tea, he cleaned his rifle, then dropped off to sleep, listening to hyenas howling. Okay, so this is the next morning. He awoke, and Bell and his party headed out to deal with the elephants they killed the evening before. And he was followed by what he described as all of the villagers, men, women, and children. And everyone was in very high spirits, quote, at the sight of the mountains of meat, unquote. And Bell explains, quote, in this country, the meat of the elephants is esteemed more highly than that of any other animal, as it contains much more fat. The Karamojan elephants are distinguished for their bodily size and the quality and size of their ivory, and for the quality of fat on them, unquote. So that's interesting and opposite of what my friend in Zimbabwe told me about elephant meat. And I suspect Bell is correct in that the elephants in that area he was hunting had more fat. And also from my reading, the natives ate anything edible. Life was not easy. Food was scarce, and it took much coordinated effort to kill for meat. So we have a caller.
We do. We
yeah,
a
caller, you are on the line.
Hello, this is Randy.
Hi, Randy.
I'm just wondering, did Mr. Bell pack a sidearm too, or did he just carry?
Yes, he had a Mauser, and I'm not going to let out any secrets now. I got to the Mauser, you know, I don't think I'm going to get to it today. I'll probably get it tomorrow, but that Mauser became very important to him because natives had seen rifles. They had never seen that before.
Okay.
And he was very accurate with it.
Wait
for the excitement. And,
thank you.
Yeah, even if I talk fast, I probably won't get to it. And then I'll trip over myself. So, okay. But thank you for calling. That's a great question. Bill, and I tried to find online what that Mauser, what it looked like, because, you know, his rifles are still in possession of a collector, but I couldn't find any information on where that might have ended up. So Bill wanted to get the tusks out of those two elephants as quickly as possible. Oh, we have another caller. Okay, caller, you're on the line.
Hey, I'm Joe Nobody, but I just got out of lunch, and I've been dying to know what elephant tastes like. Did you come up with that already?
Oh, yeah. I did it at the very first, so you can listen in the archives. So my friend, he didn't say what it tastes like, but he said it was awful. He said it was really tough meat, and you have to boil it for several days, and even then it's still tough. He called it very coarse, like coarse-grained meat. And he didn't like it. And I know what I had talked about was I actually had walked over to his mother's house with one of his daughters. And that family had killed three elephants in the years when they issued licenses for citizens to hunt in Zimbabwe. I'm not sure what the arrangement is now. But back then, families could hunt and then they could sell the meat they weren't going to eat. And his mother told me, Peter, you know, when I asked him that I talked about on the radio, he didn't like the meat at all. But his mother had told me when I was there that it wasn't really worth getting an elephant. You know, if you have an elephant and the whole tribe comes and gets it like they do for the ones that are shot on safaris or when tribes can hunt, that's one thing. But for a family to take an elephant, she said it just wasn't worth all the work to process the meat, even if you could sell some of it. So,
somebody's doing something with it, I guess.
Yeah, well, the natives, the natives. So, if you go on safari, I don't know about the other countries, but I think it's probably similar. In Zimbabwe, there's two kinds of hunts. Someone can pay to come over and shoot an elephant on safari, or the government does cull hunts. If the elephants are ruining everybody's crops or if there's one that's a dangerous animal, then the government will do calls. And the local tribes get those animals. So even if it's shot on safari, the local tribe gets it. And they actually have some say in how many elephants can be shot in that area, what they want money-wise for it. And, of course, they want the meat. And so that's how that works. So all that meat does go to the natives. So they're eating it.
Cool. All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Okay, and it's not sold anywhere. Nowadays, it's not sold anywhere.
Can't buy it.
Yeah. So I do read a lot about, because I'm curious, and when I go back there, I will go on safari, and I may try a little bit of some different meats, but I read what people think of this different meat, because some people will eat anything, and they love it, and that's part of their whole experience when they go over there. And what most people say is everything tastes like chicken, so I don't know.
Here's my thing when people say that. If it tasted like chicken, they'd call it chicken.
Yeah.
Like, truly, like, it's... I don't know. I've had kangaroo, but I've never had elephant. Yeah. I've had kangaroo, though. Yeah. I wasn't a fan.
Yeah, but I watched one shooting a crocodile, because that's what I'm interested in. And after the hunter shot it on the safari, many of the villagers came out to take the meat, but the safari took a little bit of the meat. The PHs took a little bit of the meat, and they asked the hunter if he wanted to taste it, and they built a fire right there, and they roasted a couple pieces of it, and the hunter ate it.
Oh.
So,
interesting.
Yeah, a lot of people really enjoy tasting the meats that are over there. So Bill has to get those tusks out of the elephants as quickly as possible. And remember, he had left the rest of his caravan in another location, so he was just with the Karamojans right now, and he divided them into two groups, the natives. And Bell explained to them that none of them was to touch the meat until the tusks were removed. But after the tusks had been out, they could have all of the meat. So to remove the tusk, one has to expose the bone sockets that hold the ends of the tusks. And to do this, all the skin and flesh has to be removed from the elephant's head, because a third of the length of the tusk is embedded in those sockets. And Bell says this is a difficult and tedious job to cut the skin and get through the gristle. Quote, nothing blunts a knife more quickly than elephant hide because of the sand and grit in its loose texture, unquote. Now, Bell continues to explain the detusking process by telling us that when the skull is cleaned on one side, the neck has to be cut, and this is a Herculean task, in his words. When the vertebrae are severed, the head can be turned over, and Bell says that takes 8 to 10 men. Then the other side of the head is cleaned. Quote, when both sockets are ready, an axe is used to chop them away, chip by chip, until the tusk is free. The chopping should always be done by an expert, as otherwise large chips of the tusk itself are liable to be taken by the axe, unquote. And Bell explains that normally the natives do not go through this careful axing and chopping process to remove the tusks. He said natives prefer to leave the head in the sun. Quote, they prefer to leave the sun and putrefaction to do the work for them. On the third day after death, the upper tusk can usually be drawn out without difficulty from the socket, and the underneath one on the following day, unquote. For the elephants killed on this trip, Bell says none of his crew were adept at chopping out the tusks. However, later, his Wanzamwezi boys did become experts in this process. And Bell tells us there were 12 of them who excelled at tusk removal. So that's probably for a future story.
About 20 seconds.
Oh, 20 seconds. Okay. Well, they can remove as many as 10 bull elephant tusks in one day if the elephants were killed in close proximity. And Bell takes time to describe what the natives he was working with looked like, and at one point of interest that he talked about is the men wore what Bell described as the most extraordinary looking periwigs. And I'm going to stop there because there's this whole wonderful periwig story, and next week we'll get to that and to the story about the Mauser and a few more things. Okay, take care everyone, and we'll talk next week.